Last time on Faith Uncut.
Queer theology is a way to liberate not only a historically oppressed community in the church, which is the LGBTQIA community, but also to liberate some of our thoughts about God and how we understand and conceptualize God.
I think that we also have to examine the idea that these men were presumably in the Bible, or who wrote this book, straight. Right. So you now have men who are patriarchal and saying men should lead. We have heteronormative stuff happening in terms of everyone is straight and anything that is outside of heterosexual sex is wrong or condemnable by death. So we start to enforce, in terms of systems of oppression and intersectionality, we start to enforce norms both in the Bible, and then those norms, because of religion, then go into the church.
And when you start to line those things up, certain things don't make sense. And I think sometimes it's just challenging for people, especially people who feel like they've survived these more strict interpretations, mm-hmm. and who might have made sacrifices or felt like they had to hide themselves or felt like they couldn't really be themselves. I think that it's hard for them to vacate that now there's space for them. There's power in reclamation.
For some of us, and I say us as a queer person, for some of us, maybe to be, you know, to be told that you got to fast, or that you have to, you're punished for, you know, looking, you know, or having a conversation with a boy, if you're a boy, getting whoopings and stuff like that. Like, think of the ways that we shame and harm our children's sexual formation because we, as the parents, are scared of what might happen if they are who they are. Think about the ways that we shame and enforce this heteronormative thought and belief on our kids as they grow up, and not allowing them to flourish and thrive to be who they should be, you know? And it's because, and it's not built on the kids. It's built on the parents' lack of understanding and knowledge. And then what happens is we undergird that lack of understanding and knowledge with the Bible and using that as a tool of oppression, you know? And so I grew up feeling lots of shame for my attraction to both men and women. And then when I got to college on my own, out of my parents' house, and started to be sexually active and experiment and things like that, you know, I didn't have as much shame when I had sex with women, you know, because it was like that, you know, it was like, Lord, please, you know, forgive me for this. But if I had an encounter with a man, it was like, I had so much shame, and I would be going back to the altar and saying, Lord, wash me and take this away from me. I think of Tone's song, Make Me Over, which the sound sonically is beautiful. I think the song is beautiful, but that song is filled with so much hatred. Self-hatred, because he's basically telling God that he doesn't even want to be who he is, and he wants to be made over because of his sexuality. And so that song, for me, as much as I love the sound of it, it's torturous, because you listen to this song that was popular. You have all these thousands of folks singing this song who are all singing an anthem about their identity not being enough, and that they're not worthy to even walk to talk to God because they're not worthy of his love, or even of him seeing them as a human being, because their sexuality, there's something.
This is
hugely problematic.
Yeah, and as we spoke earlier about how oppression works, mm-hmm. we are also responsible in the area of sexuality of carrying those same systems into our home. So, if, for instance, our house, we talk about how God is the head of this house, or God is head, and so a lot of our activities in our home are informed by mm-hmm. our faith. Mm-hmm. So, if our faith is uninformed. Mm-hmm. And let's say we don't explore all of this sexuality, all of the possibilities of all of this sexuality, to the point of considering that we consider God as omnipotent or omniscient or omnipresent. How do we consider God as, do we consider God as omnisexual? Shouldn't God know everything about sex? Shouldn't mm-hmm. God have experienced everything about mm-hmm. sex? Wouldn't that be an element of God? If we refuse to let God out of that little theological construct that we created, that habitat for God, and let that sexuality roam. And when we go into our homes and we deal with our partners, or we deal with our children, it rolls downhill. So an right. uninformed theology is an uninformed marriage, or an uninformed partnership, or an uninformed right. parent.
But see, it's not just the theology, though. And I just want to add, it's not just the theology, Mike. I think it's also culture. It's culture, but it's also just human development and sexuality,
yeah.
right? That in human development and sexuality, that everyone, that if you have 100 people in a room, that 100 of those people are not going to be straight, right?
So I feel like we're touching on some things that actually when you say culture, Nick, I think it's important to state that a lot of the sexual repression, the repression around sexual exploration, identity, expression has to do with repressing any characteristic that might attract what people think is negative attention to the person. And I think that's kind of traumatic within the community because you have examples of that being something that immediately puts your person in danger, might put your life in danger. So like only because, you know, I'm sitting here and I'm saying, okay, that same idea of the lack of space and the lack of affirmation in exploring exactly who you might be in your sexuality or in your expression, to me, one crosses over boundaries from, let's say, queer to heteronormative anyway. I've experienced that as a woman, as a Black woman. And a lot of it was in the shaming of Black women as hypersexualized beasts. And I say it that way because that's exactly how it was discussed. It was discussed in what we call pseudoscience that way, that we did not feel pain, that we were especially lusty. That lust was made up to justify the farming of human beings, right?
Well, right, and the rape by slave masters.
so I create you as a hypersexualized beast. The only way to put you down is to, you know, screw you real good. You understand what I'm saying? So then generations go down, and like we were talking about in previous shows, the stress, the trauma of it all, when we pass that orally or we pass that subconsciously, we don't know why we're doing some of the things that we're doing, but here's the behavior. You know, I realized that my child, my daughter, is out here, and I'm saying she's fast. I'm not worried about who's chasing her, though. You understand what I'm saying? Or I'm saying that she doesn't need to be, you know, get out of that man's face, right? As if that is a open door for a man to have liberties with a girl that he should not have, right? So that lays the responsibility at the girl's feet. You know, this old saying that they used to say about it's easier to run with your skirt up than with your pants down. So if you get caught, it was probably because your skirt was up more so than his pants being down. But what is that really saying? That's saying that women are, when left to their own devices, they just want to, you know, lay up and get fucked all the time. And this could be the furthest thing from the truth. But if a woman has experienced a negative setback from being perceived that way, she will mess around and teach her daughter that. You understand what I'm saying? So I'm hearing these things and I'm saying a lot of these things are rooted in culture. And these liberation theories, which cross over from religion to a civil society, actually are about unshackling the mind before we go for the physical shackles. The same thing happened around what is called revolutionary theory at the time where America was agitating for her freedom from Britain. The idea was, how could you agitate for freedom while you're literally putting your foot in the necks of other people? And the cognitive dissonance was off the charts. And that's what set us on the course for the Civil War. Because it couldn't be solved at that time. Why? Because I have a political interest, an economic interest, I have a religious interest, and let's say superiority as a system was taking root in a new place where it was like, we're going to benefit from defining ourselves one way so that we can keep others defined a different way. So when we start reclaiming these definitions and reclaiming this story, we're actually giving power back to the people who have been powerless.
Which is how liberation theologies work.
That's how it works.
And all liberation-based theologies are born out of a sense of urgency. So no one makes any moves when everything is status quo, and status quo is fine. But it is when you get to those extreme points of tension where you have to look at it and say, all right, what's actually happening here? Where have we gone wrong, down the wrong path? And in this case, what you have are people who have, or a community of people who have served their churches, who have helped to build their churches and foster the community and been a part of those communities, are seeing themselves not represented in leadership, not even being able to show up with a partner. And then those people go through what some of us go through for other reasons, this deconstruction of their faith. Like, wait a minute, this is bullshit. There's no way
I have to build it back up, right, if I even want to.
Right. There's no way I'm doing all of this. And you're telling me my faith is incompatible with my identity or my sexuality. Mm-hmm. There's no way that you're
not
telling me.
Not if ultimately that. If I believe that I was created in the image of God, ultimately I have to believe that every part of me was created in his image.
And
even the
me,
things that maybe you don't agree with or you don't see in yourself.
So at some point, the theology or the teaching or at the base, the faith becomes mm-hmm. incompatible, or that dissonance becomes too great.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to resolve that. And because mm-hmm. of the way that our faith spaces are structured, you cannot resolve that there. And so you start to see people leaving. So as people start to leave, and you're like, what happened? What did we do?
Right.
But you know what you did. You know exactly what you did.
Exactly.
You preached that all those Sundays, and now you're surprised that people are not trying to hear, people are not inviting.
Or that
gay
people
friends.
Are calling you out for that. You know, a prominent pastor was called out on social media because a lesbian woman sat in the audience with her mother and, you know, just took the time to email him and say, I hadn't been in a long time mm-hmm. and I wanted to go to support my mom and, you know, just to share family time with my mother doing something that we grew up doing together. And she actually placed her humanity back in front of that person and just said, I did not come here for you to make me feel less than loved, less than welcome, less than human. And you really need to check that. And I know that body as well as that leader, you know, sometimes they sensationalize that pushback mm-hmm. because it helps them make those soundbite points about, you know, faith and being persecuted and all of that. But the truth is deeper than that.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes it's hard for people to open their hand towards something that they don't understand, something that they don't live. But I thought that was very powerful for that person to do because she helped other people understand that's not why you go to church. You don't go there to feel less than.
Mm-hmm.
That's not why people should be participating in that ritual. And I feel like she shined a light on, you know, her as a person, just having to experience that from the leader of that body.
And that leader was also unapologetic in the response.
He's been unapologetic.
I mean, it's really shameful, but that is what's happening.
Yeah.
And so it was good that happened where she sent the letter. The letter was made. It was an open letter.
Mm-hmm.
And then the response was also open. And we got to see the exchange, and people who are not even a part of this community were looking at like, hold up, wait a minute. Is this what's happening?
Mm-hmm.
So it's important to see that exchange, to understand that humanity and respect it and understand this person is a person just like you.
Yeah.
And what are we doing to support this person?
Yeah.
I want to throw out just some numbers when we talk about the faith experiences of queer folks. So there was a 2014 Gallup poll, and in it, 24% of the people who identified as queer considered themselves highly religious versus the 41% of people who were non-queer. 29% of them said that they were moderately religious, as did 29% of the non-queer folks. 47% of them said that they were not religious, versus the 30% of non-queer folks. So basically you have a 17% difference of people who now identify as not religious versus folks who are not queer. Okay, so then we have queer folks. The Pew Research Center did a study in 2015. 48% of queer Americans identified as Christian, which is up from the 42% in 2013. So over the course of 2 years, 6% more folks identify as queer and Christian than in 2013. The general population, the number of Americans who identify as Christian, declined from 78% to 70.6% between 2007 and 2014. So basically, you know, in that, the number of queer Christians has risen since 2013. And I think that's some data that we really should take a pause for and say, people are coming back, or people are now identifying and claiming Christianity as a part of their identity. I also want to look at another study that said how many queer men who were raised as Christian maintain their religious identity as adults. And so in 2012, a study on gay men's retention of a Christian faith tradition, 2,000 some men were surveyed. 83.6% said that they were raised Christian. 43.2% identified as Christian at the time of the study. 28% identified as atheist or agnostic at the time of the study. So basically, you're saying that 83% of people were raised Christian, but 43% of them are still Christian. Where do the other folks go? Mm-hmm. 28.9% identified as agnostic or atheist at the time of the study. 28% identified as spiritual, but not Christian. Mm-hmm. So think about that, y'all. So we have 28% of folks who are walking around here who are spiritual and not Christian. And I think that is kind of the sweet spot. Because I think I would also fall into that 28% of people who I don't identify actually as Christian, I identify as spiritual, and I've learned about different other world religions, other faiths, and then had to figure out how do I construct my own idea of what the divine means to me outside of this context, outside of this oppressive construct.
Mm-hmm. But that in and of itself is revolutionary in that there is a mainstream construct, and when you are able to separate from it, question it, critique it, and come up with a new way to interact with it, that is raging against the machine. You know, I use this term from time to time just to describe, what does that behavior look like? When you start literally doing you are raging against the machine. Obviously, the machine has presented to you, here are your options. Here's how you are to exist. So I'm not surprised that the data fluctuates, where people probably have felt a power shift from I'm defining for myself versus it has been defined for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that power shift is important. So in your case specifically, Nick, and I don't know, like in terms of like what churches you attended and things like that, but as a seminary graduate, as a military chaplain, you are pretty much qualified to, I think you were a pastor at one point, weren't you?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah. So you don't have to find yourself, there's many people like you or similar situations that don't have to find themselves in a powerless position, because mm-hmm. you're subject to teaching of someone who maybe didn't have as much education as you. Maybe their education is dated. They went to, Bible college maybe 20, 30 years ago. They haven't done any advanced learning or coursework. They don't have the life experience because maybe they've been in one place for a long time. Mm-hmm. They don't have all the power anymore. It is possible to learn, connect with your faith in ways that are real, in ways that are relevant and applicable to you. And it doesn't have to come from the singular source of the community church, the church that we grew up in. There are other ways to get this information, and that's the space that we're living in now. And I think that's why some of the numbers look the way that they look, because it's possible now to deconstruct your faith and go through that disillusionment and betrayal and anger and things like that, and then start to understand where I misunderstood or where I was mistaught, and then to reconstruct that faith in a healthy, holistic way where you're no longer on the outside.
Right.
And you're still connected with God, and these two things, maybe an identity and your faith, are not mutually exclusive. Maybe you can actually form thoughts, and that exploration is what is exciting about this. Like mm-hmm. that you don't have to be spoon-fed this anymore. That you can mature to a point where mm-hmm. you can actually obtain this information, and I think that's. I hope for and pray for people who are find themselves in that deconstruction period, that they make it to that reconstruction where they can kind of see what this is like and shape this and it makes sense in a way that's healing for them. Because as a Christian church, we have harmed a tremendous and important member of our community. And so we have to be better about that, but they don't have to wait for us to be better. And they should not wait for us to be better, because we slow walk that, because it's comfortable for churches to do that.
Right. I'm just sitting here thinking that as, people who bear witness to that power shift, I'm just thinking about our responsibility, and I've seen people really wrestle with what is their responsibility? What should their response be? And my thing is, you have to be careful about making space to hate somebody else when you're hoping that nobody hates you like that. Mm-hmm. When you're hoping that nobody withholds love from you like that. When you think about how important love and compassion, intimacy, honesty, vulnerability really are in life's journey, Mm-hmm. You have to be extremely careful mm-hmm. about orchestrating the removal of that, the removal of access to those things for somebody else, as if someone could not orchestrate that against you. Mm-hmm. That is a right. crime against your humanity. And I feel like, you know, again, the historical record shows that when people are pushed to the margins and they have to exist there, I was sitting here, I was thinking as you were speaking, Mike, that that's the magic of the margins, because you get tired of your life being, your life is your own mainstream. Mm-hmm. It might not be anybody else's, but you can't be your own outsider, mm-hmm. right? So when you really do recenter yourself, and this has been so important to my faith walk as a Black woman, where I experienced a structure of churches that did not necessarily serve me where I was for the issues that affected me throughout the arc of my development, right? So, but yet I'm here participating, and I'm here participating, and I'm here sacrificing, and I'm here trying to fit into a posture of what it would mean to be a more faithful follower, a more faithful believer. Freedom and a truer love of God has happened where I said, this can't be what this is. This can't, you cannot possibly require this of me. And I've had experiences dealing with policies that are based on the word versus common sense versus golden rule type of stuff, right? Where I'm just like, why would you make space for hatred or for cutting off access to the things that essentially make us human so that you could feel better than the next person?
That's the goal and nature of oppression. That's the whole point. If we made equity available to everybody, then we wouldn't have anybody to oppress. And so I think when we look at oppression, when you're used to oppression, you know, or when you're used to privilege, when you're used to having a cis hetero privilege, equality, when queer right. folks start to say, oh no, we're not at the table and we don't get to talk about our narrative, that then begins to feel like oppression for you. You know, in 2013, there was a poll by the Public Religion Research Institute, and it found that a third of people who were 18 to 33 left the religion that they were brought up in because of anti-gay teachings and the treatment of queer folks as major factors in the decision to leave. Mm. You lost 33% of people, of millennials, because they said, we're not going to stay here for this anti-gay teaching. And not only just the teaching, but also how you treat folks. Yeah. And so I'm reminded of someone like Kim Burrell, who, you know, just about a year ago got up in front of the church and started talking about the ways that queer people have sex. And I remember, you know, she got up and said things that were hurtful, that were crass, and that they were untrue. She got up and said that she, you know, she talked about homosexuality as a spirit of delusion and confusion. She said that homosexuals were perverted. She told them to keep playing with the homosexual spirit and then they're going, or they will die from it. Things like that hurt people. They harm people. And what's interesting is that someone like Kim Burrell, who has a talent that she's been recognized for, she forgets that the perverted people that she talks about, those are the same hairstylists that she uses so that her wigs don't slide off. Kim Burrell forgets that her makeup artist who makes her face look ageless and near perfect for photo shoots is a queer person. That her wardrobe person who manages to get her waist trainer together so that she can look good for her stuff is a queer person. Yeah. That her creative director who ensures that the lights and the sounds and props happen when she needs them to. And so I think for me, when we look at church leadership, we have to think about the idea that churches, specifically Black churches, who were known for having these amazing music departments and choirs, like, listen, y'all, we cannot exploit people for our own personal gain and then still seek to dehumanize them.
Right.
We cannot dehumanize a group of people while still expecting to be respected in their lives. We can't extract what we need from the culture and its people while assaulting every crevice of its identity.
At this point, let me just jump in really quickly and say, you know, I had a friend to tell me, and it doesn't matter what that person might do within that church structure, right? So we want to be careful not to excuse it just because it might be the creative expression of the hairstylist or the creative director or the music director. We're just talking about people, right? Because there are people sitting there who don't have those roles, who should not be dehumanized, because that goes into the stereotype. Well, right. You know, that's how you get into stereotyping people too. These people are not just occurring in those spaces.
Right. And I'm specifically
saying, No. I was just saying for the listener.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, that we're so strongly committed to hating and using this violent language against folks. And we forget that queer people, if we're reading the same Bible, are made in the same image of God, and in the same image of God that you worship and serve.
Yep.
And so I think that we also have to remember, especially within our Black church, that people can be oppressed in an area, so we can still have oppression because of race and still maintain privilege and benefit from that privilege in other places because of gender identity and sexual orientation. Yep. And so we can think of, we have to remember that, like, we can do two things at the same time, that we can be oppressive and still be oppressed. And I think that we have to remember how those intersections happen with queer folks.
I know from my own personal journey, as I've deconstructed, reconstructed, that renewed hermeneutic is important. And arriving at that is important. I think that the resources that you need to get there. Well, so for a person who finds themselves on maybe feeling on the outside of their community, to be able to connect and find resources that would help them reconcile or clarify some of the inerrant teaching and reconcile, you know, identity with their faith or spirituality are important. Luckily, we're in a space where Google is maybe a phone unlock away, and you can actually learn about queer theologians, which is a thing. And this is why we're doing this episode, because for anyone who finds themselves in that space or has family members who may need to understand, learn more, think differently, there are people there. I was reading a book recommended by a friend of mine, Reverend Brandy, I guess I'll call her, from Marcella Altus Reed, called The Queer God. It's a theology book about God and reimagining God different ways and understanding the Trinity and things like that, and just different areas of the Bible. But then there are other resources. So that, I mean, there are things that you can do to kind of help along. I mean, but you want to get to that point where you're whole, where you're unencumbered by doctrine and historic traditions and things that did not have you in mind when they were created. They did not have your interests in mind. You know, I just want to see people be free as
that. Well, I think, oh, no, I was just going to say that I think that for me, a part of reimagining theology, one thing that I did a few years ago, you know, a lot of my work was spent as both as a pastor and as a chaplain and mental health professional, has been spent excavating other people's lives and helping folks to find, you know, purpose and meaning and work through trauma and things like that in their lives. And I spent a whole 10 years doing that as a career. And I decided that I needed to, in some ways, step away from that to excavate my own. And a part of doing that was doing the work, and we use that word, you know, that phrase, the work, but really doing a lot of self-reflection and doing some therapy, and then and also, you know, sitting in sacred spaces and going to, you know, for me it was exploring different sacred spaces to feel, where do I feel at home? Where can I sit and feel like my soul can be at ease and rest? Where can I go and feel like my spirit is being revitalized? And for me, and I'm just speaking about my journey, it wasn't in a church space. There are things that I miss about church, right? Mm-hmm. So there's, you know, I live for a good choir, and I think it just gives me memories of growing up and being in a choir. But being in a church that maybe where the pastor doesn't speak from a place of nuance and understanding of sexuality and gender identity, that thinks very traditionally about what marriage and relationships can and should look like, that's not home for me. And so what I started to do was find community of people who were thinking and exploring like me, people who were grappling with their spirituality. So that might mean, you know, us listening to music together and us getting together and just making food and just being in community and loving each other, celebrating our wins and our losses and meditating or praying with each other, offering up, you know, Thanksgiving for what we have. And so each person, I guess I'm saying all this to say that spirituality does not have to be in the construct of a church building.
Nope.
It can be. And so for those people, the 43% of folks who identified as Christian at the time of the study that I mentioned, if that for you means going to church, then you go and you be there and you get your spirit filled. But I also want to speak to the people who are not in a church building to let them know that that is also okay. And there's no condemnation for you not accessing your spirituality in a church building. So if it's in nature, if it's by doing yoga, if it's by going to the bookstore to read and better understand who you are, if that means going to a group and you're, you know, exploring faith and spirituality together, That means going on a trip where you just sit in a temple and do some cleansing and some meditations and some chakra realignment. Your spirituality is yours. And so a part of reclaiming it is not just saying to the institution that this is mine, but also saying to yourself, this is mine. And what do I want this to be? Mm-hmm. What is this for me? Who is God to me? And so one of the people who was really instrumental in my life, a really dear friend of mine, his name is Dacre Brown. He is he's a life coach and an intuitive coach. And he started to tell me that, hey, the divine is in you. You are the divine. And I know that might be problematic for some folks to think of themselves as a divine being, but it's like, if I'm made in the same image of God, then why am I not aware that the divine is who I am and it's a part of me? And so as I started to realize that, I started to realize that like everything that is around me is spiritual. And I started to see the divine in everything that I did, not just in a church building, you know? And so that's my path, but it's the point I'm making is that every person, especially the queer folks who are listening, I want y'all to think about, what does it mean for me to be connected to the divine? And how do I access that? And to start aggressively seeking out the ways to connect yourself to the divine. And if the divine is within you and who you are, how do you basically connect to yourself so that you can be you again?
I think in Christianity, there is language to complement the thought that you just conveyed, whether you're thinking being inhabited by the Holy Spirit or where you're thinking in Romans, where Paul is saying even nature attests or proclaims the glory of God, or mm-hmm. basically God's fingerprints are all over this. If God's fingerprints are on a dogwood tree, how much more are those fingerprints on you? How much more does your existence
mean to him?
Show that you are a divine creation. You are this. You are the image bearer. You are the imago Dei. This is God. This is God in you. You mm-hmm. are connected to this. This is part of you. This is within you. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, however you arrive at it with whatever language you use, the healthy space is to be able to understand that, like you said, Nick, this is yours. You shaped it. This is something that's healing and helpful to you and people around you, because mm-hmm. as you are healthy and they see you healthy, then you're happy around them. You're helping them. It feeds off of each other, just like the negative side of it feeds as you're trying mm-hmm. to oppress. Mm-hmm. So I would encourage everyone to take that, whether you find yourself queer or not. I mean, because the process of queering theology is the process of opening this up to explore and see what else is there. What else have I missed? Yeah. Because the thing that you might have missed is the thing that you or someone else may need.
Psalm 139:14 says that I will praise you because I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Wonderful are your works. My soul doth know them very well. And I just want to speak that to every person that's listening, especially the folks who identify as part of the family of queer, that you are fearfully and wonderfully made, that there's nothing wrong with you about how you're made, how you're created, that you are made in the image of the divine. And my goal, my prayer, my highest intention for you is that your soul, the deepest part of yourself, will know that. So carry that with you, that you are fearfully and wonderfully made. And the goal of spirituality, the goal of you restructuring how you believe faith, is that your soul will be in agreement with that.
Beautiful.
Thank you, brother. I appreciate that. Mm-hmm. So for this episode, we hope that you have heard us and not turned us off too early. And we want you to take this opportunity to queer theology. So thank you, Nick, for joining us.
Thanks again. For having me.
We really appreciate your insight in this. We could not have done this without you. So for Faith Uncut, I'm your host, Mike.
And I'm Amira.
And this is Nick.
For more on Faith Uncut, check us out at faithuncut.com.